I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact. I'm whispering because on this episode, we're going to be talking about spying. I'm also whispering because we're at the opening of an art exhibition. This may seem like an unusual place to begin a program about surveillance, but this exhibition, with flickering screens filled with closed-circuit TV images and thousands of photographs, is the work of Hassan Elahi, a professor at the University of Maryland, and for a short time, the subject of an FBI terrorism investigation. His story begins back in 2002. Here's Hassan.
I was returning from a flight overseas. So I'd been on the road for about a month and a half, and a rather convoluted route coming back from West Africa. Landed in Detroit at the airport there.
Your attention, please. To change levels with baggage carts safely, please use elevators.
You know, it's one of those things where you go through the passport control and the guy just swipes it through. And, you know, normally you just go in and out of that place.
Passport, please.
But this time the guy just, like, stops and doesn't even look up at me.
Come with me.
Hassan was led through a maze of corridors and into an immigration holding room.
There was someone from every part of the world, and it was a huge room, and you could just see that things were not going well. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
As a US citizen, this was not a place Hassan expected to find himself.
So it's really this bizarre situation, and it was just at that moment this FBI agent, he didn't identify himself as an FBI agent, but he was just this one guy in a dark suit, walks straight up to me and says, I expected you to be older.
This FBI agent takes Hassan to another room, and that's where the questions begin.
Where were you? Who pays for your bills? Where do you stay when you travel? Who did you meet with? Do you belong to any groups that wish to harm the United States? Is your name Hassan? Is today Tuesday?
Hassan says it was pretty clear right off the bat that he wasn't a threat to anybody. And after a few hours of interrogation, he was allowed back on a flight. He made it back home. And then, a couple of weeks later, he gets a phone call.
Hello?
And it was a man who introduced himself and says that he would like to do a follow-up to my interview in Detroit. And that's when I realized that this mess is a lot bigger and the tentacles run a lot deeper.
Now, at this stage, most people would have been anxious to preserve their privacy. Hassan took a different approach. He turned his life into an open book.
It was a very organic process because it all started with just calling the FBI and letting them know, hey, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm doing.
Flying out next week and wanted to let you guys know that I'm not running off anywhere, just give me my itinerary.
Not because I had to, but because I chose to. I wanted to make it very clear to the FBI, look guys, I don't want to raise any red flags or make it look like I'm running off somewhere. I want you guys to know, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm doing.
Northwest Flight 51 coming in from Frankfurt.
At first, the information Hassan was giving to the FBI was just his way of trying to stay out of Guantanamo Bay. He traveled a lot for his work and knew that all it would take would be for one FBI agent at an airport not to tell the next that he wasn't a threat, for the whole process of questioning to start over again. But then he started sending more and more details about pretty much everything.
And then those phone calls turned to emails, and the emails got longer, and then the emails would have photographs attached to them, and then I would build websites for them so they can look through everything. And that's when this project really started coming to take shape.
Even when the FBI investigation into him stopped, the project didn't. In fact, Hassan started sharing his information, not just with the FBI, but with everyone. Even today, if you want to know where Hassan is, all you have to do is visit his website.
Present location as of Thursday 13th March 2014 to 48 p.m. GMT negative 5 minutes and 0.
Spend long enough on his site and you can get all kinds of other information about Hassan, from the hotels he stayed in to the food he's buying.
May 25th, Empire Corner, Chinese, New York, $15.
But not everyone was happy with what Hassan was doing.
I had friends that said, hey, don't show up at my house. Or, you know, it was a peculiarity. It was this odd thing that I guess some of my friends would say that I did.
But then in 2004, a Harvard University student launched a website that changed everything.
Now nobody even thinks twice. You go to a restaurant and the first thing that happens is eight people, you know, everyone pulls out their phones. And everyone's taking pictures of everything and posting it and checking in and doing whatever.
The student was Mark Zuckerberg, and the site was called The Facebook. Soon, what Hassan was calling self-surveillance looked a lot like social media.
So now it's just become common practice. I mean, this is what, I mean, we all do this.
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, MySpace, Foursquare, OkCupid, Tumblr.
But it's amazing how short of a time this transition took place. It was just a few years ago, I had people saying, no, no, please, please don't come to my house or please don't photograph this. And now good luck trying to tell someone not to take a picture with their phone.
Whether we like it or not, Hassan says we now live in a world where everything we do, from buying groceries to browsing the internet, is creating more information about us.
Each of us generate so much data and so much information. And it's all out there. And you may say, well, I don't post anything and I don't share anything. I don't even have an email account or whatever. You can say that all you want. But who's to say that someone else isn't posting things about you? Who's to say that that company that you buy these things from isn't sharing your data with someone else? Who's to say that, well, you know, that your water company knows exactly what time of the day you shower every day?
Which brings us back to Hassan's website.
49 minutes and 53 seconds.
The interface is deliberately confusing. The information is seemingly displayed at random. One minute you might be looking at a collection of photos of unmade beds, the next, a photo of a plate of food. And Hassan says that's part of the point.
Where I'm coming from is really this idea of camouflage, where I'm doing everything. Everything that you want to know about me is there online. Whether you can find it or not, that's a whole different story. Whether you can access it or not, that makes it very different.
As Hassan says, you can't necessarily delete all the data that's out there about you.
But you can bury it by putting so much information that the real information is camouflaged. The real information is hidden. It's there, but you cannot distinguish it from the noise that's there.
22 hours, 7 minutes, and 9 seconds. Hassan still gets the occasional visit from the FBI, but only to his website. He knows that because, true to form, he's watching the people who are watching him.
I wrote this really clunky code that shows up, that basically shows me who's watching me at what time, at what point. I have all these agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, you name it, all these three-letter guys, they still show up. When we think of surveillance, you're not just, don't just think of it as one way. We can also watch the watchers. And I think that's where things really start getting interesting, because they don't like being watched.
Many thanks to Hassan Elahi for sharing his story with us. We turn from government surveillance to another group of people busy collecting your personal data, one credit card swipe at a time.
This is a mainstay of every major retailer at this point, is to collect as much data as possible.
That's Charles Duhigg.
I'm Charles Duhigg. I'm a reporter for the New York Times and the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business.
Back in 2012, Charles wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine called How Companies Learn Your Secrets. He found that some of the biggest retail companies are collecting masses of data on customers. Companies like Target.
Target collects as much information as it can about people in its stores. Everyone who walks into a Target is assigned what's known as a unique guest identification number. And then the store will try and link that up with everything they know about you.
According to Charles, Target collects that data in a number of ways.
When you go into a store and you use, for instance, a loyalty card, right, those things that you swipe at the cash register, that tells them who you are, so they can track every purchase you just made.
To find out what consumers think about all this, I've come to Target on the busiest day of the shopping year, Black Friday, to ask some of them. What's your name?
Mario.
And what are you here to buy?
Video games for my niece and nephew.
Did you know that Target keeps your information on a big database and then uses it to sell stuff back to you?
No.
How do you feel about that?
Creeped out. That's kind of creepy. But nowadays, really, every single thing does it. So information is never really private. So, I mean, it's weird that they do it, but it's not uncommon because everywhere you go, your information is scattered around. So your information is never private.
And then there's these massive data warehouses, these data bureaus. And what those companies do, those massive data warehouses, is they vacuum up as much information as they can.
These data warehouses suck up anything that's publicly known about you.
Like, for instance, whether you've gotten married or divorced, or whether you bought your house, whether you've ever been foreclosed on, whether anyone has ever sued you.
If you've registered with a political party.
If your kids are enrolled in a particular school, and that's public information, they'll get that information. Births are public information, so they know how many children you have and what their ages are. Finally, of course, there's also tracking of your internet activity. So many websites, if you go to, will download a cookie onto your internet browser, and they'll try and follow what other websites you go to try and build up a demographic profile.
So the piece I'm doing is around how Target collects the information from you about what you're buying in order to sell you more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Not completely comfortable with it. You know, a lot of information is being collected about us from everywhere that we go online.
Charles says Target has got pretty good at analyzing all this information and then using it to try and trigger our buying habits. So good, in fact, that a few years ago, they came up with something a bit unusual.
They would look at the data of people who were shopping in Target, women, and try and predict, based on how their shopping habits changed, whether they were pregnant or not.
The inventor of the pregnancy predicting machine is a guy called Andrew Pohl.
Andrew Pohl is a statistician who works for Target. He previously worked for Hallmark.
Pohl had given a talk about how Target predicted pregnancies, so Charles tracked him down and gave him a call.
He was very, gracious with his time and really enjoyed explaining to me how Target's predictive analytics department worked, how they were able to model people's shopping habits by looking at the patterns in their lives.
By looking at customers' spending habits, statisticians like Pohl were able to predict with apparent accuracy whether someone was pregnant or not. But when Target launched their advertising campaign focused on those customers, it didn't go according to plan.
The customers didn't react very well. They didn't use the coupons that were sent to them because they felt freaked out, kind of spooked by the fact that this company knew what was going on in something so intimate like having a baby without the customer telling the company.
So, Charles says, Target began disguising what they knew.
They came up with a program where they would send pregnant women who they knew were pregnant because of their models, ads for diapers or for bottles. But they started always putting them next to other ads for wine glasses or for lawnmowers.
They figured out that if coupons for pregnancy products were mixed with other kinds of adverts, people would feel less like the company had been spying on them.
You know, what's interesting is when I was working on this chapter for the book about Target, and I was talking to Andrew Pohl, my wife was actually pregnant with our second child. And we live in Brooklyn, and we shop at Target sometimes.
Charles realized that some of the things Pohl was telling him about were literally on his own doorstep.
I noticed that all of a sudden these coupons were arriving at my house that were actually exactly the coupons I needed, right? We needed to buy a crib for the baby, and we needed to buy a whole bunch of diapers and sort of just get ready, outfit the nursery. And I got all these coupons from Target for diapers and for buying a crib, the types of things that I really needed.
For Charles, being targeted by Target wasn't creepy, it was convenient. And most of the customers I spoke to at the Target store in Emeryville, California, seemed to feel the same.
What are you here to buy today?
Anything on sale that we might possibly need because we just moved to Emeryville.
We're here to buy Q-tips, and then we got all this shit.
Did you know that when you buy things at Target, they keep a lot of the information about what you bought in a big database in order to sell you more stuff?
Of course.
Do you think it's convenient or creepy?
It's creepy.
creepy but yet convenient.
But Charles says it's not just Target or even retailers. Everyone is using personal data to market products to us, even when those products are presidential candidates.
Hi, this is Barbara Bush calling for Romney for president on behalf of...
Charles found that political campaigns buy information from the same big data companies and use that data to try and figure out our habits.
A campaign doesn't want to send me a coupon. What it wants to do is it wants to profile my voting habits and figure out how to trigger them.
What can we do?
We can vote for someone with values.
Campaign for American Values.
And so what they want to do is they want to look at the millions and millions and millions of Americans who don't vote and figure out, what can I say to them that's going to trigger that voting instinct, that voting habit? Is it that I need to tell them about a particular issue? Or is it that I need to make them think about their kids and therefore feel a sense of civic duty?
We're all on our own if Romney has his way. And he's against safety nets. If you fall, it's tough luck. So I strongly suggest that you wake the f*** up.
So that's how corporations and political campaigns learn our secrets. From our purchases, our internet browsing, and by buying info from big data warehouses. But Charles says often the issue isn't what the companies know about us, but how much we know they know.
They create an image of who they are based on what they think we want to hear instead of what they really are. That, I think, is what's troubling to people. It would be like, dating someone and saying, finally, I met my soulmate. And then finding out that person dresses completely differently for every other date, and that they espouse different political views, or they care about different things every other night of the week. It's not troubling, usually, to know how much people know about us. What's troubling is when we feel like they're not being honest with us.
Charles Duhigg is a New York Times journalist and author of The Power of Habit. You're listening to Making Contact. Stay with us. This is Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Up next, we've heard about the FBI and corporate data collection, but there's a group of people the government has been gathering information on for years. People on welfare. Salima Hamarani brings us this story.
Okay. Ooh, it has music.
In early 1997, the Vallejo...
I'm in Jody Berger's living room, watching a video made by the Vallejo Police Department. Berger's a lawyer who specializes in public benefits law, and the tape was at the center of a lawsuit filed against the police department in 1997.
This video was made by the State Department of Social Services, and it was created, we believe, as a best practices or a training video. They decided that they would do an early morning visit of the apartment units that had recipients of AFTC, food stamps, and Medi-Cal.
The video shows groups of police officers interrogating residents of a low-income apartment complex, performing home searches, and asking questions.
The goal was to determine if the residents of this large apartment complex were in fact committing fraud, or if they were not correctly reporting their circumstances.
They decided that there may have been a correlation between crime in the area and receiving benefits and fraud. I'm not sure why they made that link, except for it's a stereotype and a bias, an anti-benefits bias.
The raid led to many people being disqualified from aid. A few people were even arrested. And the police gathered massive amounts of personal data on everyone they questioned, even those who were not later charged.
Lastly, this operation sent a message to those who would defraud social programs, that they will run the risk of getting caught, and the punishment will be swift and sure.
The raid raises some larger issues. In 2013, there were approximately 47 million Americans receiving food stamps. And of that number, 4.6 million were on welfare, or what we call temporary aid to needy families, TANF for short. The police video gives us some idea of what's fueling all of this intense surveillance from the welfare department. It's a topic we hear about a lot in the news.
Alleged welfare fraud.
The story of this fraud case that raises a lot of
why officials are cracking down on
fraud. Investigators
Jay?
Videos like these paint a familiar picture of rampant fraud abuse. One where recipients are living lavish lifestyles off of their welfare checks. But Some experts say that just isn't happening.
I think particularly with the so-called welfare reform that has been going on for the last 20 years or so, it has become an exceptionally difficult way of life.
That's John Gilliam, a professor of political science at Ohio University.
And it has become even more difficult to get away with anything even approaching fraud.
I tried to get in touch with welfare officials to talk to them about fraud. No one responded to our request for an interview. But according to the department's own statistics, fraud rates in welfare are extremely low. For example, in California, there were 1.3 million TANF recipients in December of 2013. Around 6,800 investigations were completed in that month, but only 114 investigations were referred for actual prosecution. That's less than 0.0001% of all TANF recipients in the state, and not all of those will even result in a penalty. But that hasn't stopped the department from creating a very sophisticated surveillance apparatus.
There is a wide array of forms and types of surveillance that a typical welfare family would face.
Just to start with, you meet with social workers, caseworkers, investigators, who ask you endless rounds of questions. You report anything related to money, or the department will uncover it. Of course, these days, all of your purchases are tracked through electronic debit cards if you're on food stamps.
That could be revealed through tax rolls or various bank accounts.
And there's a massive database collecting all of your personal information, but there's more.
In many parts of the country, there might also be drug testing required for benefits.
And your neighbors can be questioned, your children's teachers can be questioned, you can be followed, you can even be forced to undergo unannounced home searches.
So really, there's a fairly comprehensive set of tools out there to closely watch what these folks are doing.
At a meeting for an organization called Parents' Voices in San Francisco, a group of mothers volunteered to share their stories of being on welfare and under surveillance. Parents' Voices helps mothers and fathers on different kinds of public benefits. As their kids ran around the office playing, the mothers explained how it felt to be under constant scrutiny.
I felt like I was trying to do all the right things, and yet I was still, they were trying to find constant ways to either get me timed out or find ways to get me sanctioned, or I'm at your mercy. And that's a crazy type of feeling to have, because you feel like you don't have any control of your own life. You're at the mercy of their handout.
People didn't want to use their names because they were nervous about doing anything that may lead to them losing their benefits. In every story, people had been asked really personal things about their lives, from what sort of groceries they bought to who they had slept with.
They wanted to know everything, like even like when I had my kids, they wanted to know who were their dads, how many times I were with them, and did I have any sexual relationships with anybody else. Makes you feel like they're going into your private life so much.
And the woman said that that had a real effect on their lives.
You know, you have to tell them every little thing, you know, in what, how is your life going day to day, minute to minute. I am trying actually to fulfill the requirements, but it is really hard to believe that they don't believe that. I sometimes don't even have money for riding a bus, and I have to walk, and you know, it's hard decisions, but they're still investigating my poverty.
The frequent questioning of these women leads to another issue. Karen Gustafson, a welfare lawyer who teaches at the University of Connecticut, says the big problem isn't that there's not enough information, is that there's simply too much.
There's so much data collected and collected on a routine basis means it's really easy for minor problems in a case to trigger an investigation, and then they'd be hit with a fraud charge and asked to repay all of the money they had received since they had first made the mistake on paper.
And with all those forms and all of those questions at the welfare department, it's not hard for people to make a mistake. And making mistakes or being caught in a discrepancy is a big deal.
The penalties for not reporting income are pretty stiff.
If you're lucky, you might just have to pay back what the state thinks you've stolen. But things can get worse, much worse. You can be barred from receiving welfare forever in some cases. You can even go to jail. Gustafson says these days, the welfare department and the criminal justice system work hand in hand.
Well, the goals of the criminal justice system, right, capturing and punishing criminal activity have now become goals of the welfare system. Actually, the state and federal governments have spent really an uncritical amount of government resources on investigating and punishing fraud or preventing fraud, and hasn't paid much attention to poverty itself.
According to the 2012 census, there were 46.5 million people living in poverty in the U.S. Many of them are on welfare, but average grants are very low. Though the amount varies state to state, on average, a family of two receives $430 a month in cash aid. For the most part, welfare recipients are barely making ends meet. Recipients like Leilani, a 56-year-old mother of three from Stockton, who got on welfare when she was pregnant with her first child.
Initially, the first time I ever got on welfare, it was a godsend because I had nothing and I was getting ready to have a baby.
But Leilani's view of welfare changed over time. She was bothered by the amount of surveillance, even though it was the only way for her to feed herself and her child.
It's kind of, how do I explain it? In poor communities, everybody knows what the process is. Nobody questions it, and they all hate going down there, and they dread the process. But we know that if we don't do it, we're not going to get what we need.
Leilani has undergone three separate investigations, and at one point, when she was homeless and sleeping at a friend's house, she was hit with a heavy administrative penalty. She now needs to pay back a lot of the welfare money she received.
And how much do you owe them?
$2,000. A little over $2,000.
And do you have that money?
No. I work part-time right now.
How are you going to pay that back?
Don't know.
Leilani says she never found out exactly why she was hit with a fraud charge. But the experience has left its mark on her.
Being on welfare is one of the most miserable things in the world because you're under the scrutiny of the welfare department, and it's like you're constantly on camera.
Remember that raid on the apartment building in Vallejo targeting welfare recipients? Well, the residents of that apartment building asked Jody Berger to help them take the police department to court.
There was a settlement where the state agreed not to do this kind of raid and not to release people's confidential information.
But even before the ruling, mass raids like the one in Vallejo were pretty rare. Legal victories challenging welfare surveillance are even rarer. Much of that spying is actually legal. John Gilliam says there's a bigger issue here. He says a lot has changed since he first studied welfare mothers in Appalachia in the 1990s.
The technologies were kind of developed and tested in applying them to welfare populations. And now, of course, we see this as just everyday business in the United States. A lot of the practices that we now take for granted in terms of general populations started out with more vulnerable and powerless populations like the incarcerated people in the military and, of course, welfare families.
Gilliam's message is clear. Watch out what happens to others, because any of us could be next. From Making Contact, I'm Salima Hamarani.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender, and remember, whoever's listening to you, keep listening to Making Contact. Making Contact.